This spirit cannot fail you. This spirit cannot fail you. The individual who has the most power is the one who has the greatest realization of the divine presence, and to whom this means the most as an active principle in his life. Never let anything cause you to doubt your ability to demonstrate the truth.
The Annex. As a child, I was, as my elders never tired of pointing out, exceedingly accident-prone. Sad to say, I cannot refute that characterization. Few indeed were the weeks from which I emerged without a bruise, a sprain, a puncture, a burn, a minor concussion, or some combination thereof. Few the school photos unmarred by the presence of a bandage or black eye. There was no household object I could not damage, soil, or bring to flame, no apparent foodstuff I was unwilling to ingest. This inclination to calamity was not, however, the result of innate clumsiness on my part, nor was it a function of developmental delay. From a physical standpoint, I was more than capable. It stemmed, rather, from an inability, no, from a refusal, to accept limitation. That I did not have enough limbs to pull off the various feats of domestic mountaineering and spelunking that often struck me as absolutely necessary, that my stomach was not large enough to accommodate all the food I sought to put in it, that certain organic processes require the temporary cessation of play. Awareness of these facts did not spare me the harder knowledge of falling from our rooftop with the aerial in tow, or regurgitating a tree full of unripe fruit, or surreptitiously crab-walking through the house in a futile attempt to reach the toilet. What can I say? I was a child, lacking the discernment that comes with experience. I attempted too much, I made unfortunate choices, and in general, my timing was poor. Unfortunately, my penchant for mishap extended beyond my person and into the social realm. Sleepovers, for example, invariably saw me return to my own home before I had so much as unrolled my sleeping bag. Worst of all were family get-togethers, more often than not completely undone by my presence. Take Easter and the incident with the grape soda and the 24 deviled eggs. Or the 4th of July and my unfortunate three-pronged assault on my uncle's pool, noseblood, day-glow urine, a few rogue bits of stool. There was my cousin Janet's first communion and my ill-fated turn as a leisure-suited chimney sweep. And who can forget Christmas Eve, with the structural failure of my paper dessert plate and the untimely passage of my aunt's beloved Pomeranian? As my entire extended family on my mother's side lived in the same small town, each year brought gatherings for the birthdays of 7 children, 4 to 6 national holidays, 1 Super Bowl, and the occasional milestone anniversary. An annual minimum, in other words, of 12 opportunities for me to reduce an otherwise rote social occasion to near rubble. Thanksgiving, and the anniversary of my invention of the hamster cannon, loomed. Something had to be done. Discussions were held on how to curtail the fallout from my cataclysmic tendencies. Suggestions ranged from my being shadowed by one adult or another for the duration of the gathering, to placing me under a form of house arrest in a room cleared of everything save a beanbag chair and a stack of magazines, to having my grandfather, a retired furniture upholsterer, fashion a kind of hazmat suit from remnants of naga hide, polyurethane foam, and clear vinyl. My own advice, had it been solicited, would have been to simply leave me at home. In the end, my parents' recommendation carried the day. Keen to show they were no more tolerant of my behavior than anyone else, it was they who devised the most comprehensive plan, a multi-part containment strategy that included limiting my hors d'oeuvre options to plain saltines and crudité without dip, disqualification from all potentially boisterous activity, tag, Red Rover, sardines, and a modification of the usual mealtime seating arrangement. In addition to the grown-ups sitting at the grown-ups table in the dining room and kids sitting at the kids' table in the kitchen, there would also be a Leonard, me, sitting at the Leonard's table in the garage. Slouched in a metal folding chair at my makeshift table, a large wooden cable spool set on its side and covered with a daisy print oilcloth, I cast a final glance up and into the house. In what was doubtless intended as a nod to our shared humanity, the door between the kitchen and the garage had been propped open, allowing me a line of sight to the table where my sister and cousin sat, wolfing down food and drink and trading spicy knock-knock jokes. After an initial effort to include me in the merrymaking, they appeared to have forgotten me. With a shrug of resignation, I turned my attention to the plate in front of me, curated and delivered by my mother, who came and went with the guilty slither of a maternal Judas. It was a sorry sight, entirely lacking in compositional grandeur. Instead of the edible diorama I would have constructed for myself, stepped plateau of sliced turkey, crater of mashed potatoes filled with a steaming lake of gravy, rolling foothills of stuffing, fluffy clouds of ambrosia salad, I'd been left with a penitentiary-style arrangement of meager, age-appropriate portions. I was famished. Apart from a handful of saltines and a few pieces of celery, I'd eaten nothing. Despite the fact that my stomach crawled with genuine hunger, however, I couldn't bring myself to eat a single bite. A mantle of profound disinterest settled upon me, and I found I didn't care about the food before me, or the people inside the house, or the world in which they were situated. The cacophony of familiar sounds, the loud talking, the sudden guffaws, the clank of silverware on plates and tureens, the underlayment of a Johnny Mathis LP, blended into an indistinct roar, a swirling foam of discord that grew louder and louder until it was almost deafening. Then, slowly, as if an infinitely patient hand were turning a volume knob from 10 to 0, the noise began to diminish. The gradual disappearance of household racket was accompanied by a darkening at the edges of vision. Eventually, light and sound from the house no longer made it to the garage. I was, in every possible way, alone. The fluorescent tube overhead did not buzz or give off its usual soulless light. All was quiet, and the objects in the garage, the washer and dryer, the garden implements, the plywood cabinets, my uncle's workbench and tools, seemed to glow with a warm, amber light. After an interval of cryptic silence, the water heater ignited with a sudden whoosh. The metal tank gave off an ethereal hum as it warmed, an uncanny oratorio that meandered along the chromatic scale before settling into a drone in C minor. Focused as I was on the caroling water heater, I missed the moment when the object itself came into being. About the size of a plum, semi-transparent with a strange oily sheen, it looked like a metallic soap bubble. It hovered, silent and inert, in the air above my table. Whether I was looking at a bubble occupying space or merely a bubble-shaped absence of space was impossible to tell. The improbable object remained perfectly still for a few moments, then flickered rapidly in and out of shadow. As the water heater droned on, the bubble started to grow, expanding until it was roughly the size of a basketball. The flickering stopped and images began to play over its opalescent curves. Rendered in the same sourceless light as is found in certain dreams, these images were in fact combinations of words, more akin to ideas than to actual things. Autumn, innermost, hangdog. Interwoven with these word images were the shapes of other words, words that were already, or would later become, my favorites. Verdigris, apricot, surmise. I understood that I was looking onto a kind of alternate universe, one with its own set of laws, according to which space and time, light and matter, physical forces weak and strong, were subordinate to the whims and possibilities of language. I understood, too, that this other place, this beguiling sphere of word and thought, was my true home. I was not so much from it as of it. Had it been larger, I would not have hesitated to climb inside. The fact that it was all in my head, that the bubble universe floating above me did not, properly speaking, exist, changed nothing. The longer I watched it, the more I understood that my presence here, not just in the chilly garage where I sat, staring up at a hole in reality, but here, in the very heart of that reality, the world of things and gravity and family gatherings and limitation, was a form of exile, which I imagined, given my situation, as something along the lines of cut off from, a fundamental quality built into the very nature of things. Long before I managed to blunder and bludgeon my way to the Leonard table, I was aware of the fact that, compared to the people in the house, to say nothing of the people in offices and parks, the people driving automobiles and walking dogs, the people watching televisions and listening to radios, I was off. Not impaired necessarily, or incapable, or even inadequate, just somewhat askew. Finally, that askewity made sense. I did not belong here. I suspected, even then, that no one else did either. Probably, I thought, they had bubbles of their own, doubts as to their function, some vague notion, at least, that something was amiss. As I saw it, there was a choice to be made. Either you could be true to yourself, to your bubble, and thus exiled from the world, or faithful to the world as such, and instead exiled from yourself. Had everyone else, then, opted to believe that they were at home in the world? Did they really have no inkling of who they were or where they belonged? Were they really okay with being enough, I said to myself, and rightly so. It was neither the time nor the place to situate the rest of humanity in relation to an aspect of things I had only just discovered, any more than it was for me to judge the life choices of others. Instead, I resumed my quiet contemplation of the sphere, the inner and outer surfaces of which continued to flow with pleasing word images and word shapes. Moonrise, vicissitude, artichoke. A sudden tap on my chest restored me to the world I shared with others. I looked down to see a canned olive wobble across the tablecloth and come to a stop. Frowning, I peered into the kitchen. My sister was draped over her chair back, a clutch of black olives in her left hand, her eyes full of question marks. She smiled and winked. The water heater turned off with a click, its otherworldly music falling away like a shed skin. The soft, warm light emanating from everyday items disappeared, replaced by the clinical glare of the fluorescent, now abuzz with a kind of sonic malice, soundtrack of a reality that would never again be fully real to me. I looked up into the air above my table, just in time to see the bubble, now fully opaque and free of words and thoughts, contract rapidly from basketball to plum to pinhole, before blinking out of being. I felt momentarily homesick, like when you're torn from a pleasant dream into sudden wakefulness. This feeling, however, was quickly replaced by a kind of satisfied calm. True, the bubble had disappeared, leaving me once again alone, but not before placing in my head a vision, a blueprint for abiding in the world of exile. There would be an outer life with all the necessary concessions to the demands of this place. One has to eat, after all. One must have a hat and a place to hang it. One must have a friend or two, remain faithful, regardless, to one's family. There would also be an inner life, wholly devoted to recreating the conditions under which the bubble appeared. The vision led me to understand that those conditions, an annex-like space, a bit of pleasant illumination, the accidental music of a mechanical object, a certain isolated frame of mind, were the bubble. The converted linen closet, for example, where I sit writing this reminiscence, the dim light of a 25-watt bulb resting on my shoulder like a gentle hand, my ears filled with the somnolent hymn of an untuned transistor radio, reverberating inside an empty pickle jar. In the life to come, I would create and enter many such annexes. Word images and word shapes would materialize, hugging the contours of the bubble in my mind. I would content myself, for the most part, with pondering whatever manifested in this way, though occasionally I would transfer certain of the word images and word shapes to paper, arranging and rearranging them until something like meaning appeared. Olives sailed, one after the other, across the space between the kitchen and my table. I snatched them out of the air, tossing them into my mouth and chewing them into a briny paste. How I loved salty things. My customary hunger returned, surging through me like blood through a freshly unconstricted limb. I tucked into the food on my plate like a feral cat. I would devour it, then ask, as politely as possible, for more. It wasn't all bad, this place. My cheeks bulging with food, I reached for my small glass of milk, strangely happy in the certainty that I would knock it over.